So let's take a moment to bring our minds to rest. Whatever we need to rest it from. Bringing our attention, letting our attention settle into our body, like how it feels to be in this body, how our body feels in this present moment of awareness, because we often lose track of that, getting lost in thoughts and so forth, thoughts and sensory perceptions. So we're checking in with how we feel as a totality in this present moment. Just resting in that and opening our awareness into receptivity to all sensory input. We notice sounds, visual phenomena, tactile sensations, thoughts and emotions flitting through our mind. Just resting in that open awareness, including a sense of how we're feeling at this moment. And now we'll do the prayers. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great lesser and uncommon. So Lama Jinsang will do the teacher prayers and the arousing bodhicitta before her teaching. So we'll go on to the meditation for today. And for anybody who may have forgotten, and for David, I don't know if you're familiar with Zoom or not. Most people probably are by now, but you can change the appearance of the screen up in the right-hand corner. There's a little thing that says speaker view or gallery view, and if you click on it, it switches to the other view. So you can either see everybody in the whole class, or you can, or the screen will just mostly show the person who's speaking. So within this restful state of mind, which we have brought ourselves to and in which we chanted the prayers, this presentness to everything that is happening internally and externally in this present moment, not caught up in any train of thought or any emotion, just letting them come and go. We will begin the meditation. We're doing the Two Wings of Awakening, and it's especially appropriate for this chapter of Gampopa, chapter 7 on love and compassion, because we do taking and sending from the 7 points of mind training, which is about cultivating wisdom and especially compassion. So we're going to do the basic Two Wings today. And we begin by contemplating the four reminders. And we're going to again take just a little bit of extra time today. Got the wrong page out of my notebook. I'm going to read the four common preliminaries, the four thoughts or reminders from the Nundro, the English translation of the Nundro. And we're going to just allow a little extra time for contemplation today, because we've just finished all of the four thoughts in Gampopa's Ornament of Precious Liberation. And these should never become perfunctory. These are the basis of our practice. They are our motivation. They're the prod, to keep us practicing. So first, I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources. Difficult to attain, easily destroyed. From now on, I must make it meaningful. Really appreciating in a heartfelt way this opportunity that we have through all of these causes and conditions coming together that allow us to engage in study, contemplation, and meditation on the Dharma and free ourselves from the cycle of confusion and suffering. Secondly, everything is impermanent, the world and all it contains. In particular, the life of beings is as fragile as a bubble of water. The time of death is uncertain, and when I die, I will be nothing but a corpse. At that time, only the Dharma can help me. I must practice diligently. Thirdly, at the time of death, I will not be free. My fate will depend upon my previous actions. I must therefore refrain from negative actions, always engage in positive actions, and each day monitor my stream of being. Fourthly, all places, friends, pleasures, possessions, and everything else in the cycle of existence continually torment me through the three types of suffering. They are like the last meal before my execution. I must sever all attachment and diligently accomplish awakening. So now we request the blessing of the Lama or the Buddha, visualizing the Lama or the teacher with whom we feel most connected above the crown of our head, or you can visualize the Buddha or Gampopa really vividly in a body of light on a lotus and moon seat, radiating love and compassion, what we will be studying today, radiating bodhicitta, radiating awakening. And we request the blessing of the teacher or the Buddha or Gampopa that we may cultivate, we may accomplish that same level of love, compassion, and awakening. Receiving the blessing just by having asked for it and opened our heart and mind to receiving it. And then allowing the visualization of the Lama or the Buddha to descend into our heart center where it remains at all times, radiating love, compassion, and awakening whether we're aware of it or not. Now we'll count a few breaths just to really settle our minds. And go through the steps from the 7 points of mind training for cultivating ultimate bodhicitta, wisdom, resting in the nature of mind. And we don't worry about whether we're actually resting in the essence of mind, whether we're recognizing it. It's there. You know, whether we feel that we're seeing it or not, it's there. So all we have to do is rest in however it appears to us. The first step, look at all experience as a dream, whatever our environment, everything internal, all our thoughts and opinions and judgments, what if they were all just of the same quality as the dream we had last night and have already forgotten? Just letting the crispness and solidity of our perception fade a bit. Nothing is as solid or as big a deal as it sometimes seems to be. Resting and directly perceiving that. And then turning our attention inward to examine the nature of unborn awareness, just looking at the mind itself. And we can ask a question, make a little inquiry. Does the mind have a shape? Does it have a color? Any of the questions we may have learned in Vipassana meditation. Just ask, look, and rest. Not looking for an answer, just directing our attention. And then having done that, we let even the remedy release naturally, meaning we let go of wherever that inquiry brought us. Just now, just giving up all conceptuality and just resting. Rest in the essence, the basis of everything. Jom Kong Kongtrul says of this, that this is the actual method for placing the mind in the nature of all phenomena, the natural state, which is the basis of everything, which is our Buddha nature. Just let go and rest. Follow no train of thought, but rest evenly in a state in which mind itself is clear and free of conceptuality. Thoughts still come and go freely, we just don't grasp onto them. And now, having made contact with this state, our Buddha nature, the essence of everything, we cultivate love and compassion, relative bodhicitta, by doing taking and sending meditation. The slogan is, practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. So we bring to mind someone that we feel a close connection with, for whom we naturally feel love and compassion. And we wish for them to be happy, that's love. And we wish for them not to have suffering, that's compassion. Whatever kind of suffering they may have, we breathe it in. And you can use a visualization of that in-breath, what we're breathing in as a dark, smoky, hot, unpleasant substance or light representing their suffering. Breathing it in through our nostrils, through all the pores in our body, just taking it in, taking it away from the person we're thinking of or the animal we're thinking of. Letting it dissolve into the vastness of our Buddha nature, empty space, not holding on to it ourselves, but just letting it dissolve. And breathing out to them happiness, love, compassion, peace, healing, whatever they need. So I'll take a minute to keep that person or animal in mind as vividly as possible and in as heartfelt a way as possible to breathe in their suffering, breathe out happiness, compassion on the in-breath, love on the out-breath. Now, if there are other people that we love or feel a close connection with that we genuinely wish to have happiness and not have suffering, we can add them in. They can have the same kind of suffering or different kinds of suffering, because we can accommodate more than one person in this practice. Breathing in all of their suffering, letting it dissolve into our Buddha nature, which can accommodate it. Breathing out love and happiness, healing, peace, whatever they need. Doing the practice on each set of in-breaths and out-breaths, or you can space it out and do it every few sets of in- and out-breaths. Now, including someone, keeping everyone there who's there, including someone or several people that we don't have a close connection with, we may not know much about, but seeing them in the same light as beings for whom we wish to have happiness and not have suffering. Anyone you encounter in a casual way in your life, breathing in their suffering, just in as wholehearted a way as you did for the person that you love. Letting it dissolve and breathing out whatever they need. And now either staying with that for another couple of rounds, or if you can, including someone you have a difficult relationship with that you don't naturally feel compassion for, someone you know of, someone who affects your life, breathing in their suffering, acknowledging that as mean a person as they may be, they also have suffering, and that's probably where their meanness comes from. Breathing in their suffering, taking it away from them, letting it dissolve in your Buddha nature. Breathing out love and happiness to this difficult person, and skip this if it's too hard. The in-breath is the compassion of taking away their suffering. The out-breath is the love of wishing them happiness. And now, including all sentient beings in all the six realms, humans, animals, hell beings, hungry ghosts, gods, breathing in the suffering of every single sentient being whose numbers fill space. Because we have the capacity to do this, because our Buddha nature is infinite. Breathing in all that suffering, taking it away from all beings, letting it dissolve. Breathing out love, happiness, healing, and peace. If we have any suffering ourselves that is bothering us right now, we can breathe that in too, along with all the suffering and all the kinds of suffering of all sentient beings. Breathing in our own suffering through compassion for ourselves, breathing out happiness, peace, and love to ourselves, as well as all sentient beings. And now, letting go of all visualization and all conceptuality. Coming back to just resting in open awareness, resting in the nature of mind, complete receptivity, complete relaxation. Just resting. And now at your own speed, coming back to a state of mind that is ready for study and contemplation. And I will unmute Lama Jinzang.
Can you hear me? Okay. So today, I'll begin with the prayers. Okay. The teacher prayers. The first one is the four dharmas of Gompopa. Data semchen tam che lo ju su jo or sin ji lap du so ju lam du jo or sin ji lap du so lam ju par se or sin ji lap du so ju pa ye shi su jo or sin ji lap du so. I pray for a blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn towards the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom. And then from the aspiration of excellent conduct, Lai ke dan lu dan u ji ke drupu tata mi I ke nang tang dro wa kun ji dra ke ji sampar tam che ke du da ki ju ten tu. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And now a reminder for arousing bodhicitta, which is the altruistic motivation. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So those complete our preliminaries. And now we begin. I will be starting with the teachings on the third antidote, which in the Path of Buddhahood, Ringo Tuku's book, is page 50. But before I go there, I'll just refer us back also in the Path of Buddhahood text, page 31, which is just a very brief summary of the four obstacles to practice and the four antidotes, because where we begin today is working with the third antidote. So I just wanted to remind myself as well as others what we've done before, what we've covered before. So it says on page 31, did I say 31? I'm not sure what I said, but page 31, the second paragraph. Well, I'll start from the beginning, actually. If we are fortunate enough to have the first three conditions, which of course is the knowledge that we have the Buddha nature, the potential to be realized, which is Buddhahood, that we have the precious human birth at this time, which is why we are all together meeting today here, and thirdly, having a spiritual friend, a teacher, which we've met. But again, if we have all of these three, why haven't we yet become Buddhas? And Gampopa mentions four obstacles that prevent us from realizing enlightenment. The first three obstacles are excessive attachment to this life, to the busyness or activities of this life. The second obstacle is to be caught up in pleasure, to be caught up in the pleasures of samsara. The third obstacle is to be attached to or wanting the peace of nirvana as your motivation. And the fourth is ignorance of the path that leads to Buddhahood. Nevertheless, an experienced spiritual friend's instruction should help us to overcome all four of them. And there is a specific antidote for each obstacle. So the antidote to excessive attachment to this life, to the busyness activities in this life, the first antidote is meditating on impermanence, which allows us to shed the feeling of being overly attached to the experiences of this life. And to the second, contemplating and understanding the nature of samsara and its inherent sufferings, karma and its results, helps us to reduce our attachment to the sensual pleasures of this world. So we're not just attached, therefore, just to this particular life, but to any state within the six realms of samsara, that there is no, in fact, freedom from suffering in any one of those states or realms of experience. The third is by developing loving kindness and compassion, we can overcome the egotistical wish to find the peace of meditation in nirvana and to get out of samsara alone. If we see the logic of compassion, we will naturally try to attain enlightenment in order to help other beings. So again, we now exponentially increase our wish not only to benefit ourselves alone, but see that we also need and wish and have within us the natural, actual compassion already within us that once revealed would arise in the ability, the aspiration which would be fulfilled to actually benefit all beings limitless in number. And lastly, the fourth, which was the obstacle of ignorance of the path that leads to Buddhahood, the fourth antidote is developing bodhicitta, which dissipates our ignorance of how to become Buddhas. So today, we now start again, page 50, in the same text, which is now the antidote to just thinking that we are motivated to benefit ourselves alone. So it begins, if our goal in life is just limited to our own peace, our own liberation, we will never achieve the full realization of our Buddha nature. According to Mahayana Buddhism, limiting oneself to one's own liberation from the sufferings of samsara is a trap. It is not the best path. We need to develop love and compassion because it is our true nature and the only way to fully develop and awaken ourselves. What we call love here is different from the notion of romantic love. It is the aspiration, the intention expressed by the wish, may all sentient beings be happy. For a bodhisattva, loving is wishing happiness for all, for oneself as well as for others. And it's interesting because Lamanorla Rinpoche, many, many years ago in my first retreat, he said, the love that you describe now is a very self-centered, a very contracted, is a very limited love. He said, the love of enlightened Buddhas and Buddhist bodhisattvas on the path, but ultimately achieving full enlightenment, as if you could feel love equally for all beings. And he said, as an example of that, imagine, and at their time, there were about seven of us in the room, you know, in the first retreat that I was in. And he's like, imagine what it would be like if you could feel for each and everyone in this room right now, the wish that anything anyone else wants, you want to enable them to have. I mean, thinking of all the pettiness, you're in retreat, you know, or just, you know, here we all are in this retreat and we're like, we wouldn't even deal with each other if we were in the retreat, you know, we didn't know half of each other before we got in the retreat. You know, it's like, imagine if each and every one of us in the retreat at this moment, you wanted each and everyone equally, without exception, without limitation, to feel whatever they wanted, that they could have it. You know, that's what it would feel like, you know, like just unlimited giving and generosity of spirit, you know. And it always struck me that was so true and to the point, you know, that, oh my God, here you are in your room and, you know, you're supposed to be contemplating, you know, meditating, and all you're thinking, you're just bringing all whatever you're bringing into the room with you, and there's no one in the room with you, and yet you're like completely, you know, stewing over something someone said like 2 days ago, you know, with that tone that you projected as being horrible, you know. And you're like, oh, right, for all those beings, may they equally have happiness. That's what this kind of absolute infinitive, you know, in infinite love would mean. You know, that would be the experience, like no attachment to anyone and no aversion, more importantly, to anything, just equally, you know. Anyway, so moving on, but that's the kind, that's, he said, is what this kind of absolute love is. It's not a love that has any form of attachment to it. So getting back into the book, it says the starting point, so I'm in the middle of that paragraph where I left off, the starting point for developing love is realizing that if it is right for oneself to feel happy, then it is equally right for all other sentient beings. When we wish that all beings be freed from suffering, we then speak of compassion. Even though the two concepts are very close and of the same nature, slight nuances justify the distinction. So as Lama Chidren spoke before, and we'll do one half of loving kindness, of taking and sending today, but it's briefly, it's that loving kindness is the wish for all beings to have happiness and all the causes for happiness. And compassion is the wish for all beings to be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And so today we'll just probably be covering contemplation on loving kindness, which is the wish for all beings to be happy and have the causes of happiness, including oneself. So I continue in the text. It says, love and compassion are among the most important principles of Mahayana Buddhism. A Buddha, a realized being, is someone who has developed love and compassion and wisdom to their highest level. Compassion is one of the most important elements for achieving Buddhahood. Without compassion, it's impossible to become enlightened. So, not only are love and compassion indispensable for becoming enlightened, but they are also an integral part of Buddha nature. So this, for me, was very meaningful, especially significant. In continuing, it says, in contrast to hatred and other negative emotions, which are temporary and can therefore be purified, compassion is inherent to the ultimate nature of beings. When exploring the deeper forms of compassion, we discover that it is in reality one of the ingredients of the true nature of the Buddha mind. The more we develop love and compassion, the more we get rid of negative emotions. So again, the idea of romantic love or love to just certain, a limited love, that is also like hatred. That's temporary. The idea, though, is that underlying and integral to the true nature of mind is this infinite, or like the four immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, completely irrespective of any quality of the individual that it's directed at. And that is inherent to our true nature. And once we can reveal that, it's not something we have to develop. It's already there. But loving on a more limited level that does come and go like hatred or, you know, negative. I mean, that's my take on it. So anyway, here we are, and this is what we'll be concentrating today on, the development of love and kindness. So it says, Gampopa distinguishes three forms of love and kindness. One, towards sentient beings, two, with reference to the nature of reality, and three, without reference to any given object. So now we're going to be focusing on love and kindness towards sentient beings. So within this, there seem to be, So number one is benevolence with reference to sentient beings is what we usually call loving kindness. We can wonder whether it's possible to generate loving kindness or not. His Holiness the Dalai Lama answers that it's always possible to develop loving kindness because even if we may sometimes feel hate or anger, we also feel love. And it is much nicer and natural to feel love than to feel anger. We feel angry when we are disturbed. We feel love when we are not disturbed because love comes to us more naturally. We don't feel angry all the time, and as love and hate are mutually exclusive, we should try to prolong the moments when we feel love. If we succeed, we will eventually feel nothing but love. As loving kindness and anger cannot coexist, it's sufficient to develop one in order for the other to disappear. It's like hot and cold. One can't feel hot and cold at the same time. Negative emotions come and go. If we don't allow negative emotions to manifest, they will not develop. At the same time, if we habituate ourselves to feeling love and kindness, we'll feel it more often and more often. So again, this is a particular method, and it's a more basic method, and it's the idea of just when what we're trying to do is that when negative emotions come, you know, it's that old thing of think happy thoughts. You know, it's just if you find yourself indulging, ultimately, feeling attached to some set of conditions that creates negativity in your mind, to allow yourself in that moment to just think, I'm not going to go there. And instead, literally, just bring conditions up that contentment arises in the mind, or a feel of safety or relief, whatever it is that counteracts that negativity, so that you're simply, as it were, creating a new habit to not only, as it says in the book here, to lessen the habit of clinging to negative thoughts, but also creating a habit to, again, you know, go to the positive, go to the good things. You know, that's just a method. If Buddhism defines love as the wish that all sentient beings be happy, the starting point for developing this loving kindness is to realize that if we wish happiness for ourselves, all other beings have exactly the same desire. So I think this actually came up, right, in this class, this idea, is there any kind of ultimate truth? And that this idea that, yes, there's the ultimate truth that positive causes can only lead to positive results, and that negative causes to negative results. Maybe you could say that this is one of the ultimate truths, which is that not only if we want happiness and we don't want suffering, then it's probably true for every other being that nobody wants to suffer and everyone wants happiness or pleasure or happiness, we should say. So again, it says the starting point for developing this loving kindness is to realize that if we wish happiness for ourselves, all other beings have exactly the same desire. However, and this is what makes Rinko Tuco so interesting, because he's one of the first teachers I experienced that who had enough insight into Western mentality that he could address Western cultural differences. So he says, I'm aware that in the West, a certain number of people claim not to love themselves. How then can they develop love for others? Nevertheless, I think that most probably these people expect too much of themselves and feel very guilty not to be up to the high standards they set for themselves. This guilt, the blame they put on themselves, prevents them from becoming conscious of the love they actually feel for themselves. So one could say that in our culture, people blame, it's natural just in our training to say that, well, as we were treated when we were young, that you have first what you were born with, your karmic disposition, your propensities for feeling a certain way about, you know, that arise. Feel, you know, some people like, you know, the cup is half empty as opposed to half full. But there is also the fact that the environment in which you grow up in, the relationships you have within your family unit and et cetera, you know, that certain things occur that, you know, you may say, well, the blame outside, other people made me feel bad about myself. And the reason that I feel bad about myself is because other people have said things to me and that just reinforces, or that makes me feel bad about myself. Mom never complimented me and dad was always putting me down. But the reality is we've already had some sort of predisposition to feeling some way so that we were able to be affected by that kind of behavior, and it could reinforce within ourselves certain feelings. So like self-denigration, you know, I had such a severe inferiority complex when I was growing up, a terrible inferiority complex. And, you know, so some of that was certainly what I came into this world with, but I was certainly then deeply affected when people then would say things to me. I would use that to burden myself and to as a valid, external validation, that I would use that to validate my own feelings of feeling inferior. So when he says here that, again, going back, it says, nevertheless, I think that most people, now probably these people expect too much of themselves and feel very guilty not to be up to the high standards they set for themselves. This guilt, the blame they put on themselves, prevents them from being conscious of the love they actually feel for themselves. I do think at this point in my life that even though we can, you know, harbor resentment towards others in our lives, the fact is that it does come down to our own self ability to feel love for ourselves, to be aware of that. And that in the end, as I've gotten older now, one of the reasons I've been able to let go of that inferiority feeling is really being able to finally go, A, that's past. And B, that's what other things do to their own emotional afflictions, and that I don't have to let that energy in. I can actually, you know, create a boundary and let go of the emotionality that other people put out. And now it's like, what is within me? Where can I find my own strength? And letting go and realizing it doesn't matter what other people think. And that's been very interesting. And so, I don't know, that's just sort of an aside, but I think it's very interesting here when he says that, you know, it prevents them from becoming conscious of the love they actually feel for themselves. I would actually say that if not actively feeling love for myself, I wouldn't express it that way, but I would certainly say that it's allowing me to let go of the self-hate or the self, you know, the negativity I feel towards myself, such that in the absence of that, there's acceptance of myself. And so that's how I've come to understand, you know, this. And so it was very interesting for me to saying become conscious of the love we actually feel for ourselves, that we're not born with this intrinsic need to, you know, or our truly existent hatred for ourselves, or that there is nothing to hate ultimately, but that they're learning to accept ourselves, and that translates slowly into a feeling of love, perhaps. I might open this up to discussion, but we have a lot to contemplate going forward. So does anyone want to comment at this point? Because I've certainly given my little commentary. Okay, so I'll move on. So it says, how to deal with hatred. To pacify hate is the first stage in developing love. To succeed, we must first of all understand that feeling hate is absurd. We hate people because they harmed us, whether they meant to or not, and we feel hurt. However, they hurt us because they actually have no free choice. In some cases, they really believe they're doing the right thing. They allow events and circumstances to control them, or they find themselves swayed by strong and uncontrollable emotions. They've lost control of themselves. Someone completely submerged by emotions is like a madman or a drunk who can't be considered completely responsible for his or her actions. We don't take a drunk's or a mad person's words or acts seriously. We should treat people who harm us in the same way. Again, I felt this was pretty profound. And something I'd just like to share is that, is this okay that I'm sharing? Okay. So is that many years ago, well, I've had two back operations, but my first back operation I broke my back when I was 19. And when I came home from having the operation, and in those days, they didn't do all the stuff they do, like draining, blah, blah, blah. So you come home with a like gigantic half football and your back filled with liquids, blah, blah, blah. And back then, you know, the doctor I had from Columbia Presbyterian in New York, even then, he was so afraid that his patients would get addicted to painkillers that I came home from this massive back operation where at the time they took bone part from the bone, from the hip to, you know, to fuse the bone in the spine. I was on super strength Tylenol. That was it, Advil. He wouldn't give me any kind of painkiller. So there was a lot of stuff there. But I came home from the hospital that first night, and I was in college at the time, but I went home to my parents' home then in New Jersey, and my own bed in my old bedroom was very soft, the mattress. And the next day we knew we could lift the mattress and put slats, get wooden 2x4, you know, pine piece of wood to make slats to make it more rigid. But that first night, it was very soft. And my mom and dad's bed was a huge, you know, king size, queen size, whatever is the biggest bed. And it was quite, you know, it was pretty firm. And I asked, would it be okay just that first night if I could sleep on that bed? And my dad said no. I couldn't. He didn't give me the reason. He just said no. So my mom, they had to put the mattress in my room on the floor. And I had to like, I couldn't bend. So mom would hold my arm and I'm like, you know, just from the knees down onto the mattress. Well, you can imagine I developed quite a bit of anger towards my dad that I held on for quite a long time. And I, you know, and it wasn't until years later that I learned that, well, first I'll tell the story. Well, no, I'll tell you why, but then I'll tell you how I got rid of it. But I later found out that my dad, who had been crying that whole afternoon that I had been in the operation because, and then they had done something really stupid. They allowed my parents to come into the recovery room. And that's the only moment I remember in the recovery room because I must have known they were there. And I remember going, help me, help me. Well, the two of them went into the car. They were parked in the near the George Washington Bridge and just apparently just totally like cried for hours. They felt so helpless. My mother gave up her belief in God, you know, the whole thing, you know, if he wasn't going to help all those children killed in the Holocaust, he's not going to listen to me for my one child. The point is, that night, my dad was so insecure for not being able to help me that instead of being able to say, yes, sleep in our bed, he needed intensely a sense of security. He needed to sleep with my mom in their bed in the way that he knew that he felt safe. That's why he did it. But I never knew that. In any case, the point is, what I learned from Buddhism was that you always have this, I always had this idea that people should know better. They should know better. That in fact they do know better and they're making a conscious decision not to do the right thing out of self-centeredness. And then it hit me, no, dad and all beings, they're acting out of ignorance. He couldn't do any better. He had no freaking idea how to do any better. So this going back into this book where it says, you know, someone, so I'm sort of halfway through is that, you know, they've lost control of themselves. Something, they're swayed by strong and uncontrollable emotions. Someone completely submerged by emotions is like a madman or a drunk who can't be considered completely responsible for his or her actions. So we don't take them, their words or acts seriously. So the point is, I finally could generate compassion for my dad because I realized he truly couldn't help himself. He had no idea how to do differently. So it's not that he should have done better from my side saying that. It's really getting he couldn't do better. So there was no bent, there was no basis for anger on my part. And all it could be was a basis for compassion on his part. Anyway, so going back to the book, it says, the second paragraph, he says, perhaps we are wounded by unpleasant words or actions, but the one who will suffer most from their effects is the person who actually harmed us. Indeed, this person is the one who, under the influence of negative emotions, accumulates negative karma that will have negative consequences. If we believe in the law of karma, we understand that someone who harms others will suffer the painful consequences, not through any other outer intervention, but through the force of the act itself. Such a person is therefore more to be pitied than hated, and we have no reason not to forgive him or her. On the other hand, we have a good reason to feel compassion for him or her. Seen from this angle, hatred becomes almost illogical. That does not mean that we shouldn't try to stop the person from harming us or himself, but we do not need to hate him. Hatred means defeat, whereas loving kindness is a victory. Swami Vivekananda, an Indian sage, was traveling by train in India. A very bad-tempered passenger did all he could to insult him. Swami Vivekananda didn't respond. When the passenger got tired of insulting him, the Swami asked him, if someone offers you a gift, but you refuse it, who gets the gift? The passenger replied, the person who gave it. The Swami then said, I don't accept anything you said. Not answering hate with hate is a victory because hate generates tension and unpleasant sensations, while love brings peace. Free from hatred, from jealousy, greed, and discontent, we can be happy, peaceful, and comfortable in the warmth of kindness. Love is peaceful and generates a positive attitude. When nothing negative bothers us, we feel light, free, and relaxed. Those around us also feel the warmth and will be aware of our benevolence. Warm people, those with a kind heart, make everybody wish to speak to them, to be close to them. So now, extending loving kindness to all beings. To generate loving kindness and a generous heart not only means getting rid of hatred, but also wishing that all beings achieve happiness. The traditional Tibetan method to achieve this is based on the feeling of gratitude. To me, it seems only natural to want to reciprocate goodness to those who are generous towards us. Starting from this feeling, we learn to gradually extend this benevolence to all beings. The logic underlying this approach is that it's possible to gradually extend to others the intense love we feel for one person so as to finally include all other sentient beings. I don't know if this approach makes sense to you, because in reading Western books or watching Western films, I don't get the impression that gratitude or the desire to return the kindnesses shown to us plays a great role in Western society, while it's a major preoccupation with Tibetans, and I think in Oriental society in general. In a culture such as mine, this attitude is deeply anchored. For example, when people die, they regret not having had the time or the opportunity to repay kindnesses accorded them, and their last wishes are often that their relatives repay these debts of the heart. Nevertheless, the absence of such preoccupations in films or literature doesn't mean that Western people don't feel gratitude on a personal level. And here I'd just like to interject that many years ago, when Taisichu Rinpoche was at Kagyu Tipton Choling, where he was starting a course where he was hoping to go through Gampopa's text, The Ornament of Precious Liberation, word by word in Tibetan, and giving us, and that we would be translating it into English, we never got further than, like, I don't know how many pages in the first chapter. But the point is, he said, there was a real problem because Dren, which is, forgive my pronunciation, I believe is the word, but we translate as kindness. But he says the term kindness is not enough. It doesn't, again, embody the idea which Dren has to do with, again, a feeling of feeling grateful and again, repayment, that wanting to repay the kindness. It wasn't only about the kindness that one had done for oneself, but the fact that being reciprocal, that not only were you grateful to the person for the kindness that they had done or shown to you, but that equally important and integrated into that term was your wish to then repay that kindness. So that's a very different idea. So again, here we're going to work within the Tibetan and Indian tradition, which works with saying that to generate the wish of kindness then is to generate a feeling of gratefulness and wanting to repay that kindness. And so we work first with, it says here, in page 54, it says, the mother is the best example of love because she is the person who helps us in the least selfish manner. She's the one who did or tried to do her best, sacrificing her own comfort and best interests for us. This is why we feel love when thinking of our mother. And I think it's interesting to read the passage in which Gampopa describes the role of a mother. Now, I know that in our culture, there are many people who have difficulties with a parent once they're born and growing up in the early years or late, you know, under in the household. But we can at least begin with recognizing, and he will, again, if you've read the chapter, he'll address that particular thing. But I think to make this most useful then is if you've had that experience, is then to consider when it says remembering kindness is the root of love, is remembering kindness in the sense of feeling grateful. and that feeling grateful is the root of love. And at least we can all agree that through the process of being in the mother's womb and in our earliest days where the mother took care of us in the beginning of life, that even if we've had difficulties later on with a parent, at least in the context here, if you can relate to the part up to, you know, once you're born, et cetera, to at least work with that part of this material. So I think that what we want to do is adjust our posture, and we'll work with this as a form of meditation where I'll be reading and you'll just be resting your mind on what I'm saying, and then we'll take a few breaks in the reading and you can just relax, let go of the words themselves and just rest relaxed without clinging, whatever arises in the mind, just allow yourself to let go. And so what we can do is, as Lama Chidren led us before, just take a few moments now to adjust our posture. So however we're sitting, wherever we're sitting, with a straight spine to enable our, because in this posture, which is also reinforced by squaring the shoulders so that you're not slouching over and slightly tucking the chin. So the point is that with a straight spine, it enables the channels and the body to be straight, and therefore the energy or the winds in the body, which are very innately aligned with the type of conceptuality that arises, that if the channels are straight, then the winds or energy moves smoothly and the mind can most easily come to settle. And as Lama Chidren led us, so we can take just a moment to notice our body in this moment to see if we have any areas of tension or stress where we have feelings of gripping or tightness, and we can just take a moment to allow ourselves to notice and perhaps allow ourselves to just relax a little, allow ourselves to let go of the stress or the tightness just in this moment, and allow ourselves to, our minds to relax. And maybe what we can do also is use whatever, well, let's go with the breath for now. We'll just work with helping our minds to settle. So we're going to count silently to ourselves up to 21, just silently counting our breath. Now I'll begin reading. All you have to do is just listen relaxedly, and then we'll take breaks. Where again, you can just then let go of any clinging and just relax. So remembering kindness is the root of love. Thus one considers the kindness of sentient beings. In this context, the one who has been kindest of all to us in this life is our own mother. In what way? She has been kind by generating our body, kind through undergoing hardships, kind by nurturing our life force, and kind in teaching us the ways of the world. The Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 verses says, why is this? This mother gave birth to us. She underwent hardships, she gave us our lives, and taught us all about the world. So first, the kindness of creating our body. This body of ours did not start out fully grown in size, its flesh fully developed and with a healthy complexion. It developed inside our mother through the different embryonic and fetal stages, being gradually created and nourished by vital fluids coming from her very own flesh and blood. It grew thanks to the nourishment coming from the food she ate. It came into being by her having to put up with all sorts of embarrassment, sickness, and suffering. Furthermore, generally speaking, it was she who helped make this body, which started out a tiny infant, into its present bulk, as big as a yak. So let's just take a moment then to now take a moment, if you'd like, to think briefly about the words, and then again, just let go of all clinging and relax. And now the kindness of undergoing hardships. At first, we did not come here clothed, finely adorned, with money in our pocket, and with provision to travel. When we came into this unknown place, where we knew no one at all, we had nothing whatsoever. Our only wealth was our howling mouth and our empty stomach. Our mother gave us food so that we would not go hungry, drink to keep us from thirst, clothes to fend off the cold, and wealth to keep us from poverty. And it was not as though she just gave us things no longer of use to herself. She herself went without food, without drink, and without new clothes. Furthermore, not only did she sacrifice her happiness as far as this existence is concerned, she also deprived herself of using her assets or money. So one way in the spiritual Buddhist tradition as offerings, but she deprived herself of using her assets to provide for her own prosperity in future lives. In brief, without regard to her own happiness in both this life and the next, she devoted herself to rearing and caring for her child. And now you understand that the next part coming up is cultural, and even though our own parents may not have undergone this kind of austerity or these kind of what are considered evils or sins, as it said, obviously for mothers who had to work and provide, you can imagine how difficult it was to be both a parent and to have to maintain to get the provisions to keep us clothed and fed. So it says, nor was it the case that she obtained what was needed easily and pleasurably. To provide for her child, she was obliged to sin, to suffer, and to toil. She sinned by having to resort to fishing, killing animals, and so on in order to care for us. She suffered because what she gave her child was the fruit of trading, laboring the fields, and so forth, wearing the late evening or early morning frost for her boots and the stars as a hat, riding the horse of her calves, beaten by the whip of the long grass, her legs exposed to the bites of dogs and her face exposed to the looks of men. She also treated this stranger, who has become her child, with more love than her own father, mother, or lama, even though she knew not who this being was or what it would become. She looked at her child with loving eyes, gave her gentle warmth, cradled him or her in her arms, and talked with sweet words, saying, my joy, ah, my sunshine, my treasure, aren't you mommy's joy, and so forth. So again, let's take a few moments to contemplate this, and then again, let go of all clinging and just relax. Next, the kindness of nurturing our life. It is not as though we were born as we are now, knowing how to feed ourselves and endowed with the necessary ability to accomplish difficult tasks. When we were helpless, useless little worms, unable to think, our mother did not discard us, but did an inconceivable quantity of things in order to nurture our existence. She took us on her lap, protected us from fire and water, held us away from dangerous precipices, removed all harmful things, and prayed for us. At those times when she feared for our life or health, she resorted to all kinds of doctors, divinations, astrology, exorcisms, recitation of texts, special ceremonies, and so on. So again, let's just take a moment to consider this. And then just let go and relax. The kindness of teaching us the ways of the world. At first, we were not the clever, experienced, strong-minded people we are now. Apart from being able to bawl, let's cry, and flap our limbs about, we were quite ignorant. When we did not know how to feed ourselves, it was she who taught us how to eat. When we knew not how to dress ourselves, it was she who taught us. When we did not know how to walk, it was she who taught us. When we could not even speak, it was she who taught us, repeating mama, dada, and so on. Having taught us various crafts and skills, she helped us to become a balanced being, strengthening our weaker points and introducing us to the unfamiliar. And now the instructions for the actual meditation on kindness. Recalling the kindness shown by her in the ways described above every time she was your mother in the past and contemplating it all, you will recognize that her kindness has been absolutely immeasurable. Bearing this carefully in mind, cultivate as sincerely and as frequently as possible a loving, positive, mind longing for her happiness. And now I'm going to skip to page 62. Again, you can follow or you can just meditate with just to the middle of the paragraph. So this idea is that having developed this strong feeling, okay, so we'll start with that, where again, considering what we've just heard regarding our mother in this lifetime, bearing this carefully in mind, cultivate as sincerely as frequently as possible a loving, positive mind longing for her happiness. And I must say it's very interesting to me that, you know, this is very cultural because now in our generation, you know, or, you know, not only how we act, but possibly in previous, you know, if you had a parent, a father who acted in this way, it's fine to, again, use your father as a figure to work with in this meditation, because again, you're remembering the kindness that was given to you, developing a feeling of gratefulness, and in that, developing a wish that these beings have only love and happiness in their life. So again, working with your mother, or if you had a father who you feel extended this type of kindness to you, first begin to generate as much as possible, a loving, positive mind longing for their happiness. And for many of us whose parent is no longer root parent in the world as we know it, then imagining that wherever they are, in whatever form they are, in whatever realm they're experiencing, that they have only happiness and the causes for happiness. And then I'm picking up in page 62, it says in the middle of the paragraph, having developed this strong feeling, you try to extend it to other beings, aware that you once had with all other beings the same relationship that you now had with this person. We've wandered in samsara for such a long time that all beings have at some point been our mothers, our close relatives, or our friends. All these beings have had the same love and kindness for us as the love and kindness that our mother has extended to us in this life. It's therefore normal to feel for them the same love, the same gratitude that we feel for our mother in this life. The basic idea is that if we can love one person very strongly, we can develop the same feeling for 2, 10, or 1,000 people or more. First, we develop benevolence for those who are close to us, and then we extend these feelings to those to whom we are indifferent, and finally include our enemies. So again, we'll just take a few moments to first having considered the person, the parent that we feel most, that we feel connected to the most in terms of having been kind to us. We now can bring into our realm of experience, think of those who we know, relatives or friends, those who have also extended to us love and kindness. And in a wish to just remembering the kindnesses they've shown to us, that we have the feeling that these beings now all experience only the causes for happiness and happiness. So both the happiness and the causes for happiness. And now if you're able to think of those who have harmed you or hurt you or have in your own mind generate a feeling of negativity that you project onto them, remembering that all beings acting out of ignorance just like ourselves, acting from the false notion of there being a truly existent self and being completely incapable of controlling their emotions. So like a madman or a drunk being led to act in ways that they have no control over, recognizing that they cannot do otherwise. It's not that they choose to, they simply absolutely have no idea how not to. If you're able to generate a sense of, again, of recognizing that these beings also want happiness in their lives, that you want to generate for them the feeling that may these beings also have happiness and the causes of happiness. And finally, just extending it to all beings, those all beings infinite in number. Just think, may all beings have happiness. May all beings have the causes of happiness. And then you can let go of clinging to that thought and just relax. And now, coming back to a state of being aware of the world in which we are right now, let's return now to page 56. And this is where Ringo Tuku just presents his thoughts on the difficulties that many Westerners have regarding their difficulty with, you know, later relationships with their mothers. And he says, "What do you think? I am sure that many of you don't agree. Many Westerners are resistant on this matter because of difficulties in their relationship with their mothers. I'd simply like to say that too often a mother's love is taken for granted and considered to be something natural. You often expect too much from your parents. You trace the origin of all your problems to your childhood and put the blame on your parents for everything that went wrong. In a way, this attitude is linked to your lack of belief in reincarnation. Seeing no other possible reason, you think that everything that happens to you can only be the result of events that happened in this present life, during gestation, after your birth, or during your childhood. You think that a mother's love is natural, and you accept it as such without any greater appreciation. You consider all that you receive from your parents as something that they owe you. When your mother gives you everything she has, you think it's normal and natural. You don't even acknowledge it. On the other hand, you find it difficult to forgive her smallest selfish act. The slightest error is badly received, and you resent her for it. However, if you think of it, a baby is a totally helpless being at its mother's mercy. She could easily kill it at birth or even before. Infanticide exists. In certain countries, the birth of a daughter is seen as a catastrophe because a dowry must be provided at the moment of marriage. Consequently, a baby girl runs a real risk of being killed. Furthermore, a mother is just a sentient being like everyone else with her own problems, her own tastes, likes, and dislikes. Suppose a mother abandons her child at birth to follow another man whom she has fallen in love with. We might think that she doesn't love her child, whereas in fact, she is only under the influence of a violent passion. We could safely say that she's not really in control of herself. We can, of course, disapprove of her behavior as a mother, but we have no reason to hate her. Actually, if your mother didn't love or help you, it is her problem. You can't make someone love you. If she loves you and shows you kindness, that's all very well, but she's under no obligation to do so. What have you done to deserve her love? I don't think it is logical to hate someone because he or her doesn't love you. No logical reason justifies all that a mother does for her child. Instead of resenting her for the smallest mistake she may have committed, we should, on the contrary, feel grateful to her for all the good things she has given us. I think it's very important to remember this." And now I'll just finish today with going over the next heading, which is training and dealing with emotions. When we encounter difficult and conflicting situations, we're usually too overpowered by our own negative emotions to have the time or the presence of mind to think of love. Simply listening to teachings about love and compassion won't change us immediately or transform us on the spot into perfect bodhisattvas. We will, of course, flare up in anger again, especially if we're of an angry disposition. We should feel neither guilty or even uneasy if this happens. What is important is not to get attached to this anger, not to feed it or attempt to justify it. There's a difference between getting angry and feeding anger. Even Talopa said that the simple fact of being angry doesn't do us much wrong. However, the attachment to anger and the desire for revenge are really bad and can harm us greatly. We should consider what benefit there is in maintaining this anger, in being attached to it. There's none. It only hurts us and hurts others. By developing love and kindness, we can gradually change. By remaining vigilant and conscious of the uselessness of anger, we'll be better able to control ourselves. will gradually get less and less often angry over little things, and the intensity of our anger will also diminish. It doesn't mean that we should hold back and repress all feelings of anger, but simply that we should change the orientation of our mind. Emotions are like waves, and they always calm down. Whenever we become conscious that we're angry, we should try to divert our attention to something else that can take the place of our angry feelings. So this speaks back to the earlier practice it comes up next. It says, there are great many techniques designed to help deal with and transform negative emotions. Buddhism is in fact mainly centered on such techniques, which we will go into detail later. There are three different levels in dealing with emotions. The path of the Shravakas, so those are the hearers, that of the Mahayana, and the Tantric path. The vehicle of the Shravakas teaches the antidote, and this is what he spoke of earlier. The way to deal with a negative emotion is to think of the opposite emotion. When we feel angry, we think of something that generates love and compassion, which replace anger. We don't suppress anger. We just try to feel love and compassion instead of anger. There is suppression when we're filled with anger but don't express it. Whereas here is completely different. We forget about the anger and think only of love and compassion. Anger is no longer present. It's like heating a room so that the cold disappears. We don't repress the cold. We simply heat the room. That's the way of the Shravakas, the general Buddhist path, the first stage. So that's the path again, where instead of indulging ourselves or holding on to whatever is creating negativity in our mind, we simply recognize that. And in a moment, you could say, like for me, I go, well, instead of going there, I'm going to try to think of things that actually just make me feel relaxed or happy. And it's simply a change of attitude, a change of conditions. So you simply let go of feeling bad because you're now thinking about something good. The second method for dealing with one's emotions is that of the Mahayana, which consists in understanding emptiness, shunyata's emptiness, along with the previous method. In other words, if we understand the true nature of anger, the real nature of the mind, when anger appears, all we have to do is contemplate that there is no one to irritate us, no one getting angry, and no anger inside of us existing independently. So remember, for something to truly exist, we have there are three requirements: that something from its own side is permanent, is unchanging, and is independently existing, independent of any kind of perception, anything other from its own side. It exists always with the same qualities, the same characteristics. So it says, to arrive at this understanding, there are two techniques: analysis and meditation. We can approach the emotion by analyzing it intellectually, or we can contemplate it through meditation. We let anger invade us and we look at it. We'll then discover that anger doesn't exist independently. In both cases, anger disappears. More precisely, we discover that there is no one thing, no like particular material thing that we can isolate as an I, or as this idea, anger. The anger disappears through our understanding, our realization of the true nature of phenomena and of our mind. That is the way of Majjhimaka, the way of the Bodhisattvas. Finally, there is the tantric method of the Vajrayana, which is the total of acceptance of anger as it manifests. We see the anger arising and we let it come without fighting it back. We then relax into the anger, which disappears by itself. It can no longer affect us because we have no negative feeling toward it. We're neither for it nor against it. We are conscious of its presence, but not attached to it. We simply let ourselves relax in this anger, which dissolves of its own accord and transforms into wisdom. We speak in this case of liberation from emotion through wisdom, or liberation through wisdom. These are the three Buddhist methods for controlling emotions. Try to use all the three methods either in this or in random order. So now I'm going to stop here because it's now 3:26. And I don't feel I should be talking any more necessarily about these methods, just because I don't know at which level of training people in this class have had. So it's not appropriate necessarily for me to speak anymore. But if we do have a moment, if we want to take, if someone has a question or a comment, but then we're approaching 3:30, which we have to end the class. But if,
well, I'm just, I'm sending you like a note for you to read. It doesn't have to be discussed in class at this moment, but.
Okay. So if anyone has something they want to bring up now, briefly. I'm not saying the other ideas that are being discussed of how to approach the practice of anger, I won't speak to, but you know, I'll just work with the levels that everyone in the class is at, you know, especially with the Vajrayana, I meant. Patrick?
Oops, I'm unmuting him.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, go, Patrick.
Got it. I'm interested in the notion of karmic debtors, that the parent or the other party in the relationship, it helps you to really realize that maybe they have some karmic role to play that you don't understand yet.
Well, in the sense that, I mean, debt goes both directions. So I guess what it's really talking about here again is, like he's saying, if we recognize that there were previous lives of all beings exactly, that we have no idea what our previous relationships were with our parents, nor, you know, and nor do they know what relationship and debt they have to us. So that basically when anger is arising or a feeling negativity between people are arising, you know, we don't know. We only can say that in each situation, it's not born of nothing. Like they're saying, like, why is it people that you just meet and you don't get along with? It's like, you've just met them. What could be, you know, why would we not, or why do we instantly have a feeling of closeness to people? Why do we have a feeling of aversion to others? That previously there's some kind of karmic debt. There's some kind of relationship where something negative occurred on one side or the other. That's now the consequences of that are playing out in this life. Does that speak to what you're talking about?
Kind of, yeah. That's enough.
Okay. So I guess right now it is 3:29, so we should finish, but you know, we'll continue with this next week and work with love and with compassion, which again is the idea of not wanting others to have suffering or the causes of suffering. So we'll then complete today's session with dedication. So we read one time, right, in English, and children, we read the fourth one. Okay.
Yeah.
So next week, I will be down in Florida. Yay! So I'll have a different background. It'll be a little, but I will be continuing the classes just from down there. So, okay.
Will we get to meet your dad?
Sure. If he's up. Yeah. Oh, yeah, because okay. This is 2:00. Sure. I'll introduce you to Dad. Okay. This may, do you do that or do you just read it? Do you do a little, like this merit will it wane?
Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah, we kind of chant it.
Chant it, okay. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kundu Zampo and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication, please fulfill. Thank you, everyone.
I'll unmute everybody. Okay, we're all unmuted.